Welcome to this week's edition of the Aquila Report and Weekly Review. I'm your co-host, Paul Harrell, alongside our guest co-host. Once again, we've got Ryan Beasy is back with us, a teaching elder within the PCA. Ryan, welcome back, sir. Thanks so much for guest hosting with me today.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's great to be back after my 1 week suspension. Thanks for allowing me to be in your virtual presence again.
I mean, Dominic and I had plans to record. He was going to be in Egypt, teaching. He's been gone for the last couple of weeks, and then but my recording day got, my schedule just got totally blown up. And then I don't think wherever he was ended up being, he didn't have internet like he thought he was going to. So that's why we missed last week. So apologies, little program note there, apologies to the viewers that we missed a top 10 list, at least analyzing one. And Dominic will be back next week. It will be normal, regular scheduled programming next week. But Ryan, I really do appreciate it. It's always great when you step in.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Enjoy.
Okay. So number 10, we'll start with number 10. I'll go 10 through 6, and Ryan will go. And this is good this way because he's in the top, the last top five, so this way he doesn't have to talk about himself, although he will do that in a minute. So number 10, we have Akos Balog or Balog. We were just talking about how he needs to create a website called the Balog Balog. He needs to create a blog called the Blog Blog. Anyway, as a bloke, I had a Barbie moment reading this book on masculinity. That's number 10 for last week. Number 9, Dean Davis, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, a response to President Trump's new pro-choice states' rights position on abortion. Coming in at number 8, Casey Chalk, as Christianity declines, we must confront the threat of pagan America. Number 7, Vern S. Poythress, 10 lesser known references to Jesus in the Old Testament. And number 6, Ryan Beasy, back on the list, we need to support the PCA's agencies.
Thanks. And number 5, about a close confessional communion by Gregory Baus. Number 4, the dangerous logic of hate crimes by Carl R. Truman. Number 3, a brief review, The Widening of God's Mercy, Sexuality Within the Biblical Story by Robert A.J. Gagnon. And number 2, Reasons to Oppose Background Checks in the PCA by Christopher Brown. And number 1, Carl Truman on Trump versus Biden by Ron DiGiacomo.
Yeah, so this is number 1 here. I'll just start and then I'll let you comment, Ryan, if that's okay.
Yes.
Ron DiGiacomo. Which his name, by the way, it's like, I love that last name, DiGiacomo. It's like such, it just rolls off the tongue. Truman's latest masterpiece contrasts what he calls Trumpite evangelicalism with Biden's brand of devout Catholicism. Okay, so Truman here, or this is DiGiacomo commenting on Truman. And, you know, he's talking about that, he wants confidence. He says, my confidence is not so much that most evangelicals will make the correct choice, though I believe they will, but that they will be fully persuaded over who they believe to be the correct choice. Again, when we have been offered two polarizing candidates with glaringly antithetical agendas, and why have so little confidence in the ability of the brethren to develop individual and strong convictions by November? So he's essentially saying, maybe on face value, it's a tough choice, Ryan, but we should be able to confidently go one way or the other. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, there was a bit of hostility toward Professor Truman that I detected in the article, and that's fine, but it does need to be noted. He laments that for Truman, both candidates are a little different. So then how shall we vote? With those sorts of canceling out variables off the table, is there anything left, asked DiGiacomo, to evaluate that might keep us from flipping a coin on November 5th? And of course there is, right? He says, consider this. Hasn't Truman yet considered for himself the value of which candidate would more likely appoint judges that align with his Christian worldview, or be more inclined to defend the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and rule of law, if not also biblical principles. It seemed to be channeling some of Rosaria Butterfield's aphorism to know what time it is. Although all individual evangelicals won't vote for the same candidate, the question at hand is not which candidate will garner the most evangelical votes, but which I believe demands an obvious answer. After all, this isn't 1976 Cord versus Carter, but 2024. Right? We need to know that this is not, you know, the middle of the 20th century. This is the middle of the 21st century. And we have two diametrically opposed visions for the country in both the in the two parties that are running.
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating piece. And, you know, for me personally, it just comes down to who's more likely to which administration is more likely to put Christians in boxcars. You know,
as I was wondering if that was where you were going.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'll go with it. And, you know, it's pretty clear. Yeah. And there's I'm grateful, though, that we're having this discussion, Ryan, and I'm grateful there's an article coming up about Trump's abortion stance, you know, a couple of weeks ago. I covered this extensively in my day job, just how offensive it was. It's not as though that Trump coming out, you know, for rape, incest and the life of the mother, these exceptions that he has always taken. And, you know, we're watching the pro-life movement become the pro-choice movement. It was the fact that the most offensive thing, at least for me, and the most demoralizing thing among people, you know, considering voting for him over the other guy that wants to put Christians in boxcars, I suspect, was the fact that, hey, we need to let these, you know, pink haired women in blue states murder their babies if we want to win elections. You know, that's kind of the, you know, when you get to that level, you're like, oh, you know, if that's what it takes to win elections, then, you know, if we lose, we lose. Right. Like, or if he loses, he loses. And so I'm sure that piece is going to address that coming up here in just a moment. The second, number two on the list is reasons to oppose background checks in the PCA. So the 51st PCA General Assembly in June 2024 will consider five overtures requesting amending the Book of Church Order to require background checks for ordained church leaders. Ryan Beasy, I know you are, you know, in the thick of all things General Assembly. You definitely keep a track of it, just as close, if not more so than Dominic. Although I don't want to get in any sort of competition, but what are your thoughts on this background checks? Are you opposed to it, or just tell us what the article says?
Well, I'll start there. He gives basically three reasons. Background checks, number one, do not indicate a man's Christian character or fitness for ministry. He says it may prejudice his session against him simply because he has a legal conviction in his past. If one argues that John is not above reproach because of his past, we must concede that the Apostle Paul was not above reproach and could be disqualified from ministry in the PCA. I don't find that argument persuasive. I think if John hasn't acknowledged a conviction in his past and it comes up in a background check before a session, I think that they would be right in, to use his verb, prejudice against him. Why didn't you raise this? Now, if it was something like a speeding ticket, that's different. But if it was, you know, 20 years ago, you were convicted of embezzlement and you didn't share that in your Christian testimony, that's a problem. Number two, the use of background checks can lead to entanglement with the civil magistrate in approving ordained leaders. He says, the civil magistrate becomes involved in the church's vetting of elders and deacons. Proponents will argue the state does not approve or deny ordination. That's true, he grants. However, the civil magistrate who bears the sword must be separate from the church whose authority is only spiritual. If the PCA implements mandatory background checks, the church must necessarily involve the magistrate, however indirectly, in the ordination of leaders. I found this second reason to be faulty argumentation. We're simply gathering publicly available data, right? If a session does a Google search on a potential officer candidate, as they should, right? Every pulpit committee should do a Google search on their pastor. Church members should regularly Google their pastor, right? Gabe Williams has that as his as a hashtag copyrighted, I think. Google your pastor. We're not involving big tech in the ordination of officers if we Google our pastor. Likewise, simply paying $10 or $50 or $100 for a background check is not involving the civil magistrate. We're simply getting official information. And third, he says, rationale given for mandatory background checks is tenuous at best. He says, as I have argued above, it is not a judge of a man's moral character or present spiritual maturity or his adherence to the biblical leadership requirements. And that's true, but I don't know that anyone is saying that it is. But he does make a very good point here. What is not explained is how a legal background check will warn if a ministry candidate has the potential for, quote, abusive leadership, which is a nebulous concept and difficult to define. And this, I think, is the most important aspect of his article, and it's a warning that we are not heeding, right? Abuse, or the allegation of abuse, has become the trump card in the in this decade, just as racism was the trump card a decade or so ago. All you had to do is claim a decade ago that someone was racist, and you had defeated all their arguments. Well, here, all you have to do is advocate for something in the name of, quote, preventing abuse, and people will immediately stop thinking and insist upon an action. And that's a very dangerous place to be as a church or any organization. So he does highlight an issue, but he seems also to presume some motives here, that mandating background checks, he says, is certainly the church's attempt to please both the world and the state. I don't think we should presume that motive. I think there are reasons to oppose mandatory background checks in the PCA, but I don't think Teaching Elder Brown's essay offers many good ones.
Yeah, he concludes by obviously saying that they should reject all five overtures to require background checks for ordained leaders, a practice that is both unwise, and he says, and again, that's he says it's unbiblical. Of course, that's his point of view and the argument there. And yeah. It made number two. I mean, you know, it made number two. Why, Brian? Because people are curious about this issue, because a lot of PCAers read this
blog. Yes, I think it's an important thing to consider. I don't find his arguments persuasive. I think a better reason would be some of the reasons articulated by Brad Isbell for opposing background checks on a General Assembly-wide level. This should be done by different courts, that the General Assembly should encourage, but not mandate that the presbyteries in session implement background checks. But I thought these were largely red herrings. But nonetheless, he does make a very good point that we don't need to do something simply because it will allegedly prevent abuse, whatever that means.
Right. And again, same rule as 2 weeks ago. If I move on too quickly and you have something else to add, just cut me off and we can keep talking about it. But
if I keep rambling, just cut me off.
Okay. So. Number three, we have again Robert Gagnon, a brief review, the widening of God's mercy, sexuality within the biblical story. It says the two Hays argue that God, who is ever changing his mind to broaden, widen, and expand his grace and mercy in order to include more and more people, has already gone ahead of our debates and expanded his grace to embrace full inclusion of LGBTQ people in Christian communities. He says, this is again Gagnon, sadly, Richard Hays, professor emeritus of Duke Divinity School, has backslidden into heresy, reneging on his decades-old published rejection of homosexual practice as immoral. He used to be the main go-to person on the issue until his work was eclipsed by my own more extensive work in 2001 and following. So this is, I saw this on Christian Twitter. There was a lot of outrage by this, by Richard Hays, seemingly going against his thoughts on the alphabet enclave. So what are your thoughts, Ryan Beasy?
Yes, you know, there have been attempts over the last generation or so to portray sodomite lust and sodomite behavior as within the pale of Christian ethics. But he responds, this is a nonsense claim. There is no exegetical or hermeneutical difficulty that would give this sort of ambiguity. The text that the authors of this book are claiming, they speak directly to the issue of homosexual practice and transgenderism understood in their ancient Near Eastern and Greco-Roman contexts, says Gagnon, and taking into consideration the flaws of, quote, new knowledge arguments, these texts decisively demonstrate a strong biblical witness against these behaviors from ancient Israel through early Christianity. And he promises a lengthier review to follow. He has, you know, if you read nothing of this article, read the 4 points, which I thought were good applications that are more like principles that would apply to any literature of this sort. So I commend that to the readers.
Well, so yeah, number one, just to kind of park here just for a little bit, those 4 points, Jesus didn't widen God's mercy on sexual ethics by approving of egregious sin and canceling the need for repentance. Number two, most importantly, Jesus viewed a male-female prerequisite for sexual ethics as the foundation for all sexual ethics, including the limitation of two persons to a sexual bond, monogamy. Number three, and there's more on each one of those points, the widening of the sphere of God's mercy to include Gentiles is a poor analogy, a poor basis for widening it to include homosexual practice and transgenderism, which, unlike being Gentiles, are direct moral offenses. Nor do analogies to slavery, women, and divorce justify an embrace of homosexual practice. Number four, sooner should the church embrace adults, consensual polyamory and adult consensual incest, both of which are prohibited on the basis of a male to a female foundation for sexual ethics grounded in creation. Homosexual practice is worse because it's an attack on the very foundation of sexual ethics at creation. So, yeah, I mean, I think we've seen this. You see this in a lot of areas, but right now we're kind of, you know, and there's people out there that remark on this, Ryan, and they say, wow, thank goodness that the Bible perfectly allows all of the main like sins in our society. Like, you know, thank goodness, what a coincidence that according to them, right, the Bible is allowing all of these, fits in our society perfectly, right? There's nothing in the Bible that will offend us if we just look at it the way these progressives want us to. No one will ever be offended by it.
Yes, just put on these special glasses and you won't see anything that isn't rose colored.
That's right. Okay, so number four, Carl R. Truman, The Dangerous Logic of Hate Crimes. Scotland's vague new hate crime law is anything but reasonable. The problem here is that today, reasonable has no real content. Indeed, the legislation uses the adjective reasonable again and again as the essential criteria in judging whether an act or statement is a crime, but it offers no definition. That is surely a worrying lacuna. We should remember that this is a world where J.K. Rowling, to me, perfectly reasonable, her claim that we don't need to talk about people who menstruate because we have the term women can be described by GLAAD as dangerous. GLAAD, the organization, you know, for gay people. So Carl R. Truman doing a great job, as always, you know, describing, articulating, you know, what issues that we're facing here. You know, hate crimes, I've been saying, Ryan, are really just modern day blasphemy laws, right? Like, right, what was your, right. And it's also just kind of really creepy, like 1984, like, okay, so you committed this crime, like, what was your state of mind? Like, what was going through your head while you were creating, while you were committing this crime? And depending on your thoughts, you're going to get a harsher sentence or a lighter sentence.
Right. And just to, you know, a reminder for Christians everywhere, don't answer questions. You know, don't, you know, what is it they say? Don't talk to the police. Don't answer questions. You're not in the United Kingdom or this country. Don't answer their questions, because anything you say can and certainly will be used against you. We saw with that woman who was praying outside an abortion clinic in the United Kingdom. They asked her what she was doing, and she said going for a walk. And she said, and they asked, you know, well, would you be praying? And she said, well, I might be praying. And that was the basis that they gave her a ticket, because she was praying silently in her head. She had committed a thought crime. By its very definition. Well, here now in Scotland, the motive of the crime is more serious than the nature of the crime itself. As Truman points out, there is no definition for reasonable, and the law, it is paramount that the law define its terms. If there's no definition, how are we to know what is prohibited? And we see that even in the church courts. You know, someone will say, you know, such and such is intemperate, but then they won't define what is intemperate. I know a number of SJC cases in the PCA where that has been an issue, where the court didn't actually record what was intemperate. So to hear what is reasonable, who decides what is reasonable? Does the person with a beard, purple hair, in a dress get to decide what's reasonable? Apparently
so. Yes, they do. Yeah, I'm reminded of just what a threat, what we're really just seeing the mask come off, what a threat belief in a higher power is becoming to the state, right? And so just this weekend, in response to the priest in Australia, pastor, or I don't know if you call him pastor, but Mari Emanuel, you know, he was stabbed by that, that Muslim, 15-year-old Muslim. So there's a guy in the UK, Ryan, I think he's posted on social media, like, it's time for Christians to stand up. Well, he gets a visit from the police, and he recorded it. He gets a visit from the police and a mental health counselor. all because he made a social media post just saying, hey, it's time for Christians to stand up. And the, and, you know, and the fact that obviously the UK has been totally, they're demographically been decimated by the immigration of Muslims. And it's just crazy. And I, you know, this started way, way, way back. I can remember covering the Tea Party movement in 2010. And there was a scandal. Nothing really came of it because no one is ever held accountable in government, right? When they're like actually found out. But Lois Lerner was the head of the IRS, and the IRS, she was sicking the IRS agents on these new Tea Party groups who were taking advantage of the 501c3 structure in order to, you know, get funds and exist. And in the persecution over on these 501c3 Tea Party groups, there were letters that were released, and they were kind of shaking down the organization, and they had a back and forth. And one of the things they asked was, okay, well, what do you do at your meetings? And they said, well, we open up in prayer. And the IRS says, well,
what do you pray for?
When you pray, what are the content of your prayers? And it's like, wow, what a threat. You know, they, they're threatened by anybody that believes in a higher power, you know, that's above the state. And we see when that happens, we know what human beings are capable of. It's not a question of why, it's really a question of when.
Indeed.
So anyway, the logic of hate crimes. This is a great piece by Carl Truman, The Dangerous Logic of Hate Crimes. Scotland's vague new hate crime laws, anything but reasonable. Number five from last week, we have Gregory Bouse. About close confessional communion, why credible profession of faith of penitent baptized church members is not the biblically sufficient criteria for admission to the Lord's Supper. Wow. Okay. I feel like you need to address this one just immediately, Ryan, as a...
Well, you know, I'm impressed that this one made it into the so high on the list. It certainly is a very precise discussion. But many PCA, OPC, NAPARC churches, that which is required for communing at the Lord's table is simply a credible profession of faith. And so a Baptist might come, an Arminian might be admitted to the table. However, what Mr. Bouse is arguing for is a more robust requirement, not simply of professing believer, but who share the confession of faith with the church. He warns the practical consequence of admitting to the supper communion those who decidedly object to certain teachings of the church is ultimately refusing to discipline without censure on these points, and declaring that ultimately one need not submit to the discipline of the church concerning those doctrines. So if you have disagreements with the doctrine, you're free to come to the table, even though the church says, you know, that God particularly redeems and atones for those whom he has saved, for example, but you might reject that. And so he concludes, since we are forbidden by God himself to worship him in any way not prescribed in his word, then the only profitable way to convince those who hold this view of close confessional communion and to participate in the supper communion that includes those who openly disagree with the church's teaching is to convince them that admitting such people is warranted by scripture, contrary to the evidence presented in the article. So certainly something for deeper discussion.
Well, so what that would practically mean is, so I am a Presbyterian and a happy one, but I come from a long line of Baptists. And so if I have like family visiting, like that, like happened this past Christmas, you know, I had family that was visiting and they came to church with us and we observed the Lord's Supper. Because they don't subscribe to the Westminster, they would be the if this policy were implemented, the table would be fenced for them. Is am I reading this right?
It could be. I think that the latitude or narrowness, the closeness, as it were, would depend on the individual session. But it could be. It could very well be.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that would be that would make things a little awkward. just a little. All right. So that's number five. Check it out. Food for thought. Number six, we have Ryan Beasy. We need to support. He says we need to support the PCA's agencies. So he says, Ryan, you say old school PCA confessionalists have long exhibited ambivalence toward the institutions of the PCA. You say it's time we embrace them with a view toward making them thoroughly reformed. So it's not every day, ladies and gentlemen, that we actually get to interview the guy. Like, we have special guest host Ryan Beasy. He made it on the top 10. We didn't rig the system. This is literally, this happened. And he's on here. And so we now get to interview him specifically about this article that he wrote. Ryan, welcome to the Aquila Report. how are you, sir? Great. Glad that you could come on. What can you tell us? Why did you feel the need to write this article?
Well, it started as because of a dialogue I had with an administrator at the college, Covenant College, who didn't like something that a guest on the podcast I am privileged to host, something that a guest said. And I addressed that in the article, but it got me thinking that, you know, guys on the old school side of the PCA, we profess love for the PCA because of her polity and her theology. But those on the new school, the missional progressive end, seem to love the PCA not so much because of her theology, but her institutions and the agencies for engaging the culture. And so the result is that new schoolers are more willing to tolerate theological error and heterodoxy in order to engage the culture and share the gospel as the PCA, so long as those errors and heterodox views don't strike at the vitals. But old schoolers are more prone to simply ignore the agencies of the PCA and their permanent committees entirely and just leave them to the new schoolers, the moderates, you know, the missional progressives, whatever you want to call them. And instead, old schoolers, we found our own institutions, right? We've done a very good job at founding our own institutions, you know, parachurch organizations that old schoolers have founded, in fact, are doing a better job serving the PCA than some of our own agencies. Right? In the article, I give the example of Little Greenville Seminary, founded in the mid-80s. Greenville Seminary now sends more pastors into the PCA than Covenant Seminary, our, quote, official seminary.
Wow.
And so my argument is, well, rather than merely building our own parachurch organizations, and I'm not saying that we should stop that, but we should take an interest in the agencies of the PCA and try to get elected to their boards and shape their trajectory and fix the problems that we see. Because in my opinion, if the PCA is going to have a seminary, for example, it should be the best reformed seminary in the English-speaking world. Now, is that the reputation Covenant Seminary has today? Likewise, for our other agencies, rather than neglect them, I say let's have the old school wing of the PCA start supporting them by serving them, by finding men who are willing to serve on those permanent committees and agency boards.
So this was a topic on a recent podcast, your podcast, which we did mention at the top of the program, but the Westminster Standard podcast. I see if you click on the hyperlink, you go from the Aquila Report to your Substack, which I would encourage people to subscribe to that. Really good stuff. But you had on, Ben Ratliff, correct? That's one of my
Ben Ratliff and Nate Sanders, a member of my presbytery. Yes.
Well, I want to give a shout out to Ben because today, as a matter of fact, he just launched. And other men have launched a new website, kind of going to be for articles about, you know, Reformed faith, called Reforming Men. So you can go to reformingmen.com. I would imagine that you'll start seeing some of these articles that are going to come out featured on the Aquila Report. And who knows, maybe they'll make the top 10. But anyway, just shout out to Ben Ratliff for this new website that I just was made aware of today, reformingmen.com. So check that out. You know, that's interesting about how the old school doesn't want to, or at least maybe seems to have a little bit of an allergy, Ryan, to get involved and kind of make the existing infrastructure, work more for the old school way of thinking instead of the progressive. And, you know, I think that just comes from in many ways, I honestly feel like there's some people that just want to be non-confrontational to a fault. And because it would require getting political, this word that, you know, a lot of people don't like. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, it's just the nature of dealing with other human beings, especially in an ecclesiastical context where people have a vote. You know, I mean, it's just is what it is. It's going to, you call it what you want. I mean, it's going to get political and you're going to have to go in and advocate for your ideas. And in so doing, you have to point out the flaws of other people's ideas and why this is not a good direction and this is a better direction. And a lot of times, especially in the old school, that's not to say that the old school is full of old people, That's not true. I mean, that there are older people that are, you know, maybe kind of tired of it all, but there are plenty of young folks. But you just kind of the idea kind of going in with your elbows out, I think some people feel like is not nice. And then right. We have this whole definition of, well, what does nice mean in the context of what's our, you know, biblical responsibility here? So anyway, I'd love to hear your answer to that.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. That is easier to just found a new seminary. And to continue the illustration with Greenville versus Covenant, Greenville was initially intended to be a branch of Covenant Seminary in upstate Carolina. But for various reasons, that didn't work out. And so they founded their own seminary. But it's a lot harder and requires a lot more patience to slowly try to get old school men, more old school men, because there are old school men on the boards of all of our agencies, but to get more old school men on and to wait to vote out or to wait for the retirement of men who have more new school, progressive, even moderate views. So yeah, it's hard. It's a little bit easier just to found something new. And I think we should do both, right? We have great seminaries, RTS, you know, most everybody knows the importance of RTS to the founding of the PCA. RTS, you know, has provided the PCA with, I think, either the largest number or maybe even at this point, most of her pastors. I can't remember the precise statistic that Legan Duncan quoted at the last RTS Lunch General Assembly. I'm sure we'll get an update in a couple of months on where the rankings lie. But yeah, right. It's hard to vote people off, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You know, and people inevitably, you know, are going to take things personally when they shouldn't. Right. I mean, that, again, is kind of part of human nature as well. So that's a great article, by the way. I Ryan, really, seriously, I'm not just saying that because you're here. Number seven, we have Vern Poitras. 10 lesser known references to Jesus in the Old Testament. Signs that point to Jesus. So one of them from Numbers 22:22 through 35, we should not overlook the role of Balaam's donkey. The donkey spoke and functioned as a prophet to Balaam himself, serving to rescue him from the death by avoiding the angel with his drawn sword. The rescue of Balaam is a type pointing us to Christ, who permanently and definitively rescues us from sin and death. This list is a beginning. By studying the Old Testament and carefully, we can find many other points at which the Old Testament provides shadows and symbols pointing forward to the definitive redemption in Christ. I feel like this is my favorite part of the podcast so far. Mm-hmm. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I love articles like this because it really whets people's appetite to study the scripture more. You know, just a few of them, it highlights Enoch, you know, Enoch who was taken but didn't die, anticipating Christ's resurrection, the crossing of the Red Sea, that the people of Israel went down to the midst of the waters of the sea, symbolizing death, and they came up on the other side, symbolizing resurrection. It's foreshadowing the death and resurrection of Christ, says Poitras. Also, that event is called a baptism, one in which they didn't get wet and are certainly not immersed. But, you know, Paul, some people were immersed in the Red Sea at baptism. Do you remember who they were?
Yeah, I do. The Egyptians. I think there's still people trying to find, or they have found. I think some have found Egyptian chariots and stuff.
I'm sure.
Yeah, that's wild. This
wonderful
is a great
article.
Yeah, it's wonderful because it's not. I mean, you could say, well, where are some parts in the Old Testament that point to Christ? Well, there's Passover. I'm like, well, yeah. That's not this article. These are more obscure. And so that's why it's so interesting. And it'll certainly, I feel like this is going to be edifying. And Balaam, you know, there's a list of 10. Balaam's donkey was number 10, but, you know, they put it at the front of the article. So check this out. This will be great for small group discussion. I mean, it's really neat to see the Old Testament revealed in the New and vice versa. New Testament concealed in the Old. Number eight, Casey Chalk. As Christianity declines, we must confront the threat of pagan America. I have no doubt the result will be the making of many saints. So Christians cannot simply escape into their little ghettos. The Christian religion cannot avoid witnessing in the public square, and its adherents, whether they be doctors, lawyers, teachers, government employees, business owners, or landscapers, cannot help but have their work informed by their faith. The battle, even if it is a losing one, must be fought in every place inhabited by faithful Christians, an exemplar of Hunter's faithful presence in the disastrously post-Christian society. So, I mean, this article, Ryan, just brings to mind a few things, right? I was on Twitter and I saw that there was a clip of Votie Baucham talking about how, you know, neutrality moving forward is just not an option. I mean, you may think it is, but then your daughter's running track and somebody gets on the block beside her that's clearly a man, right? What are you going to do? You're going to continue participating in that nonsense, or are you going to have to make a stand and, you know, at the very least say, okay, well, we're not doing track anymore. And, you know, in that there's, you know, suffering in that. I think about the people, the Christians who are going to likely go to jail for 11 years for, you know, singing outside an abortion clinic because, you know, in the wake of Roe versus Wade being overturned, people really want, you know, the human sacrifice to continue. But in all of that, okay, there's also stories out there, Ryan, that the FBI has now been tasked to infiltrate Christian churches, to essentially spy on them, to, you know, because there's this idea that Christians are a domestic terror threat, right? And I just think this is, if this is a widespread phenomenon, I will not be surprised if many of these FBI agents end up becoming believers themselves, because I pray for that. That's the way it works, right?
Uh-huh. The word, yeah. Sacrament prayer.
Amen.
Yeah, the word leads people to be born again. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, go ahead and comment on this article.
Well, you know, on your point there, you know, Saul, King Saul tried the same thing, and the agents he sent ended up becoming prophets, and then Saul also became a prophet at a point when he was trying to act against the Lord's anointed. So God mocks his enemies. He sits in heaven and laughs. But you know, there's something of a subtle critique, and maybe it's not so subtle, of Hunter's faithful presence model, right? Hunter said Christians should focus on living authentically Christian lives in our families and communities and spheres of influence rather than programmatic political or cultural solution. So he's saying, well, we need to do more than just live faithful lives, like the former head of the National Institutes of Health did under the previous regime. But in pagan America, the decline of Christianity in the dark age to come, Federalist senior editor John Daniel Davidson offers an even more pessimistic perspective, right? So things aren't going to getting any better. And he says, you know, irrationalism is on full display in the growing popularity of superstitious beliefs such as horoscopes, crystals, and an unwavering faith in, quote, the science, even when what, quote, the science declares is reversed only a short time after it was considered dogma. And right, we've seen that. You probably covered that in your day job, how the science is really just based in faith.
You got to wait 6 months. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But his thesis is an increasingly secular America is not ushering in a rational, neutral, indifferent regime, but rather a revitalized form of paganism. And so he says, you know, we need to be combative on the local level. Not angry combative, yes, but he exhorts his readers to take back local institutions such as city councils, public libraries, and school boards. Christians, he urges, should be banning drag performances and pornographic pro-trans books from local libraries and schools, and applying pressure by refusing to patronize businesses and brands that embrace pagan morality. And isn't that what we said a couple of weeks ago before my 1 week suspension of county over country? All right, pay attention to the local election. That matters in many ways, even more than who is sitting in that little Oval Office up in D.C. But engage for battle for the control of society, because there can be no middle way, he says. And so his conclusion, that battle, even if it is a losing one, must be fought in every place inhabited by faithful Christians. And so don't just do your job well. Of course, do your job well, but vote and be willing, again, to serve on the library board, to serve as a state representative, to serve as a district attorney, because especially in these days, district attorneys have a lot of power and discretion.
Yeah. And that's why George Soros gives a lot of them his money. They're not obviously Christian district attorneys. This is really good. I'm glad that you talked about the local and brought that aspect of the article up, because it's very, very, it really is the path forward. As long as the federal government, as long as we have, you have a finite amount of time, but you have a lot of, for lack of a better word, it's just to use the traditional categories, red states, red counties, red wards or whatever. And, most of them are Christian. Most of the people in these states are in these counties are Christians. They claim to be Christians. At least their hearts, seem to be bent towards Christ. And I know there's a lot of different, denominations and ecumenical, cooperation that takes place when, everybody kind of votes for a candidate, but there really is room there for the time being to do things like that, to make the trans lifestyle illegal. Right. And maybe not just for kids, to make the, to take these drag shows and make them illegal, or at least the taking kids to them, the books. I mean, I've seen this in my home state of Arkansas. I mean, it really has happened, and there's been laws passed to try to, rein in these public schools and these county libraries. And it's a good thing until, the Supreme Court comes down with some sort of Roe versus Wade type decision that says, okay, can't govern yourselves in this way, like they did in 73, where we were all having these little debates over abortion. And now we get to have those debates again, which is a perfect, I think that's a perfect segue into this number 9 story, unless you have anything to add, Ryan.
Well, I just, one thing that, as long as we are a federal republic, the local matters. Now, if we become a unitary republic where, the district attorney is appointed by the regime in D.C., well, that's – but take advantage, full advantage of the civil and secular rights that we have in our civil constitution.
While we still have them.
Yes. That's the way the Apostle Paul lived, right? He demanded the full extent of his civil rights, even disobeying the civil magistrate when he gave an unlawful order. But that's opening another worm of cans.
Yes. Yes. All right. So, but that's a good segue here to a stone. So this is the next one. Dean Davis writing, "A Stone of Stumbling and a Rock of Offense, a Response to President Trump's New Pro-Choice States' Rights Position on Abortion. What is the way forward for pastors, church members, and all traditional Americans?" He writes, "We must be well-informed active citizens. We must remind ourselves of the founding principles of the nation and embrace them afresh. We must proclaim to all the sanctity of human life. We must advocate for its full protection under law. More concretely, we must urge the SCOTUS to do its duty to implement the 14th Amendment and protect the right of life to all Americans, including the unborn, the handicapped, and the aged. Failing that, we must advocate for a personhood or human life amendment to the U.S. Constitution, thereby compelling the SCOTUS to do its duty." Now, essentially what Trump came out and did is came out against a federal ban, which is what a lot of people want. We're seeing the pro-life movement morph into the pro-choice movement. I didn't realize, I've been in this fight specifically at my local level as somebody who covered, was in radio for 10 years covering my state, Arkansas. And we fought and fought and fought in, passed pro-life laws. We did this knowing that they were going to get challenged in court, but you did it anyway. You were trying to, Roe versus Wade is the law of the land, but we have to do some sort of, baby triage and like, okay, well, what can we get passed? Like, we've got to say,
can we do 20 weeks?
We do 20 weeks. Like, baby can feel pain. Let's make an argument about that. Okay. Did we save some babies this year? Okay. Yeah, we did. In my mind though, I'm obviously thinking, well, abolition is obviously what I'm, that's my goal. Little did I know there are other people that are just like, no, we just want to regulate it, a little bit more than the other side does. And that's what we're finding out now. And it's sad because you had Trump come out and talk about, well, it's whatever the people decide. It's whatever the people decide. It's like, okay, well, let's just let the people make another golden calf and let's see how that works out for us. You know what I mean? It was just,
right.
But Trump is not some sort of, he is certainly embracing what most people, I think a lot of people in our country today embrace, that idea or whatever. So, but it was still demoralizing, and it's got people, you know, trying to figure out, well, where do we go from here? And that kind of loops back in with our number one article. Is it the number one or no, number two? No, hang on. Carl Truman on Trump versus Biden. So our number one article going back, Carl Truman on Trump versus Biden, a critique of that. You know, people are still saying, you know, you've got some people saying there's no way that I could cast a vote for Trump after what he said. And then you have others that are like, well, hang on a second. Like, we're at a lesser of two evils moment here. So anyway, I'll shut up and listen. I'll hang up and listen. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, what Trump and many people believe, well, let the people decide, that neglects the fact that we are not a democracy, that this nation was founded as a constitutional federal republic. And our Constitution provides, as Dean Davis notes, for the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so simply because the majority believe that it is acceptable to murder a human who is not yet born doesn't mean that it should be acceptable. And Trump, I don't know who is advising the former president now, but he's getting bad advice, right? If his intent in this statement was to win over some middle voters, they're not going to be won over by just make it legal in Ohio but illegal in Kentucky. That's not going to fly. I think with this, the way to continue to win elections is to be consistent, to be logically and philosophically consistent.
Yeah.
And that's what Dean Davis warns about. He says, you know, there are reasons for the danger in adopting this punting, this ambivalent 10th Amendment approach. It ignores God's will. It misunderstands the role of government. And third, it misreads the nature of America's founding documents. He says,
well, there's a fear. Yeah. The fear is losing. It's almost being ashamed of God's standard, and they're afraid of losing elections. It's like they can't just they're not going to trust God to say, I'm going to stand on the truth. And if we lose, we lose. But I've got to stand on the truth. They really do believe, the people advising Trump and Trump himself. I mean, he's a New York billionaire. We know he's always had these exceptions, rape, incest, life of the mother. But I mean, it is just men arbitrarily drawing lines in the sand. It was like, well, between now and now, you know, like, yeah. Is a baby not a baby? Now and now, instead of what the real standard should be.
And those rape, incest, life of the mother are such a small minority. Okay, sure. Even if we were to grant those exceptions, we're talking about 1 in 10,000, 1 in 1,000 cases. So let's make laws based on what is common and ordinary, and let's not make laws based on what is a hard case. And you know, the rape, incest, life of the mother is that's a red herring, in my opinion. Let's talk about the principle. A human being is a human being. It is wrong to kill a human being without just cause.
It is.
You know, right.
But they want to win elections that are probably fake anyway, if we're being real. Yeah. We're going to open another can of worms. We could open that one.
Yeah. But I appreciated his conclusion in a call to prayer at the end of the article there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's no question that, like, well, I think we talked about this 2 weeks ago. The Republican Party is the only party where there's actually a debate to be had over issues. You don't have that in the Democrat. They're locked up, you know, except maybe for the Palestinian thing right now. But that's just an outlier. Like, they are totally locked up. Right. And we're the only party where you actually have a debate. Now, you know, the same uniparty forces keep winning, obviously. Like, they don't really care what we think. But just in terms of having access, you know, there will be room in a hypothetical Trump administration or a government. There would be room for pro-lifers and abolitionists to work there. There is no such room with the other side. Right. So. But in my opinion, just from a journalistic standpoint, Trump came out with that decision or with that statement because he got tipped off that the Arizona Supreme Court was about to come down and rule that their 1860 pre-state territorial law would take effect, banning abortion in Arizona, right? And he wants to win Arizona. Many people think he won it last time, but I mean, he wants to actually win. And that's why he did this. And Carrie Lake followed immediately after that, the U.S. Senate candidate. And she essentially adopted a 1990s Hillary Clinton, like, pro, you know, baby murder. Like, I chose life, but I need, you know, somebody else can maybe not choose life. And, but we need to incentivize, you know, children and reward families with a new tax structure. It's like, my goodness, what is going on? And so, yeah, there, we do need to pray. The irony is not lost on me. It's like, we're going to do all this so we can win elections and we can be in charge of a baby murdering nation. Like, oh, congratulations. What an achievement. But that's me being black-pilled. I called myself the other day, Ryan Beasy, a black pill bulimic. So I'll take the black pill every now and then Paul, I throw it up.
I believe that's pill of color.
Pill of color. Yeah, but anyway, and then I throw up the pill, the black pill, the pill of color, and then I pray for this Tower of Babel 2.0 to the construction of it to cease. And that's kind of my normal prayer at this point right now when it comes to me being a layperson and engaged in this culture war.
Oh.
Anyway, yeah, anything else or I'm moving on?
Let's move on.
All right, number 10, finally, number 10. ACOS blog or blog. I apologize to this gentleman for not pronouncing his name correctly. He says, as a bloke, which I guess that means he's from Australia. As a bloke, I had a Barbie moment. Quote Barbie, end quote. Is that like shrimp on the Barbie? A Barbie moment. Reading this book on masculinity, when we understand who we're turning up for and what we really value, turning up again and again starts to feel different. While following Jesus, he writes, does bring meaning and purpose that nothing else can bring. Life can still feel mundane. So what's the answer? Stuart takes us to a surprising passage of the Bible where the Apostle Paul writes about God's power working in the lives of believers so that they might have great endurance and patience, Colossians 1:11. At first blush, that sounds so ordinary. That's good the way he wrote that. That sounds so ... ordinary. God's mighty work in someone to give them something so ordinary as endurance and patience. What about miracles, healings, converting thousands? But there is enormous power in just turning up, in enduring, in being patient. Ryan, what are your thoughts on this last article?
Yes, it was very ordinary. You know, it's written by a Hungarian living in Australia, I believe. But he says, going to work, coming home, taking kids to their activities, eat, sleep, repeat, day after day, week after week, year after year, and throw in a stressful job, aging parents and teenage kids that revel in arguing about everything. For many men, it's a recipe for despair. But, you know, that's ordinary. And we're called to faithfulness in the ordinary. That's what Paul writes about God's power working in the lives of believers that they might have great endurance and patience, right? As you said. But what else are we called to, right? We're called to be faithful in the ordinary times until the Lord Jesus comes again. And he says, if we're Christian, God gives us the power to keep turning up, to keep showing up with all endurance and patience. And over time, over a long time, we can and often will make a difference, even through lives that are often mundane and ordinary. So, yeah, it's hard. It's hard now, right? You know, my son broke his arm last week, and hard. He's okay. But, you know, it's hard. But, you know, that's an ordinary part of life, and God gives us endurance and patience as we ask, as we wait upon him. And that's what it's called to be a man. You know, being a man isn't just out there with a finely chiseled beard, you know, as a lumberjack. Being a man is being impatient.
You have a beard, though?
No, that's
exactly what somebody without a beard would say, Ryan.
That's right. That's right. I can get a neck beard, which no one wants to
see. I'm just messing with you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your thought. You were on mute. Go ahead.
I have a face for radio. But but yeah, we need to be faithful in the ordinary things. You know, people want to go to a conference. They want to go to this quick fix to make them more serious, more holy, more smart, more whatever. Well, what makes you more serious, more holy, more smart? Faithful plodding, day by day, week by week, as Aklos Balog says right here.
Yeah, and so this book, there's a book by A.I. Stewart, The Manual, Getting Masculinity Right. It's kind of linked towards the bottom of this article, so check that out. Ryan, my friend, Ryan Beasy, it's always great to talk to you. Make sure you tell everybody where they can get your podcast, what the Westminster Standard podcast.
Yes, it's on wherever you get, you know, iTunes,
of course, right?
Google, Substack. You can find it on the YouTube if you want to give Google some more money.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, it's always great to talk to you. Yes, sir. Really appreciate your insights and your thoughts, folks. Just make sure you go to theaquilareport.com and check out the articles throughout the week. They post, 56 articles a week. And then you get to determine based on popularity, you know, what makes it on the top 10. And we really do appreciate it. I know Dominic appreciates it. Dominic and myself will be back with you next week. And so until then, Ryan, I'm going to let you give an exhortation.
All right. Well, may the Lord bless you and keep you in his grace. I look forward to talking to you all again in the future.
All right. Everybody have a great week.
Likewise. Thanks.